Welcome to Open Book. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jason Minidakis, who is the artistic director of Marin Theater Company, located in Mill Valley, currently running The Glass Menagerie by Tennessee Williams through December 18th. And we're going to talk about what Marin has done in the past year, what we're looking forward to coming up. We're also going to talk specifically about Tennessee Williams and The Glass Menagerie. What I noticed is different, at least to me, about this production is that the focus is on the narrator, Tom, rather than on the mother character, Amanda. And Tom is, I guess, in a way, Tennessee Williams.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it is, without question, his most autobiographical play. A lot of the things that happened to the Wingfield family in the play and that have happened to them leading up to the events of the play, you can see the relationship between those events and what happened in Tennessee's own life. He and his family moved from the Deep South to St. Louis because their father, Cornelius, got a job in St. Louis at a shoe company, and he was going to be traveling around selling shoes. And in the play, Tom and his family moved from the Deep South to St. Louis so that his dad can take a job with the telephone company. Tom gets a job with the shoe company. So, you know, you can see him pulling things from life and twisting them just a little bit. His sister in real life, Rose, did have some emotional instability in terms of her makeup. And his sister, Laura, in the play, Tom's sister, Laura, is also not what we would consider a fully functioning emotionally in the play either. So there are a lot of things. His mother was a faded Southern belle, much as Amanda is in the play. She did her best to kind of instill this very gentlemanly-like quality in her son, but at the same time, she was a very needy woman, very similar to Amanda in the play. So there are a lot of things back and forth between the play and Tennessee's real life, besides just his name. His name was actually Tom Lanier Williams.
And The Glass Menagerie, this is a collection of glass animals that Laura has. Did Rose have a collection like that?
She did, actually. When they moved to St. Louis, Tennessee helped Rose paint her room. They painted it entirely in white, and she kept the shades drawn all the time, partly because her window looked out onto a brick alleyway that was filled with fire escapes and people's laundry, and a neighborhood dog had a tendency of chasing stray alley cats into this alley, and they would get into fights in the alley, and the dog would kill the cats. And Rose, every morning, would wake up after this horrific fight would happen at night in the alley, and she would see the corpse of the cat outside. So she kept her shades drawn, and that kept the room in kind of a perpetual state of kind of gloom or twilight. And in order to brighten it up, she and Tennessee painted the entire room white, and then they went out and bought little glass animals that they put all around her room to help bounce the light around and kind of gave it this very fairy tale like dreamy quality in the room.
Why do you think he named the play The Glass Menagerie?
As you mentioned, a lot of productions have really focused on Amanda. The way I look at the play, it's very much a love letter from Tennessee or Tom to his sister. You know, just speaking within the play, Tom begins the play with a hello to the audience and to his sister. He ends the play with a goodbye. He also talks about his father, who sent them a postcard when he left them from Mexico that basically had two words on it, hello and goodbye, and no address. So much as Dad sent a postcard back to the family to say, I'm leaving, I think in a lot of ways this play is both Tennessee and Tom's hello and goodbye to an apology to his sister, Laura, or Rose, depending on who you're thinking about. So for me, in our production, certainly, we're really focused on the relationship between Tom and Laura. And because of that, you can really see how the thing that has always helped Laura get through is the glass menagerie. That is the world within which she is comfortable, within which she has the most confidence, within which she takes the most comfort and the most joy. So that world is very representative of the world inside the apartment. Laura is safe in that world with her mother and Tom. And the first scene of the play is a remarkably comfortable scene. Lara is currently, to the best of everybody's knowledge, at school. She's learning how to be a secretary. Tom's job is going well down at the shoe company. Amanda's doing a little bit of extra work to bring in a little bit of extra money, but the family is on track. And it was interesting talking to the actors about it because, you know, when we were playing it, they were looking for all the signifiers that something was about to go wrong. And it was really interesting because there's a fight that happens in that scene, but it's a fight that you could see at any household on any given night when a family is right on top of each other. In that first scene, you actually really see that things are going okay. It's the second scene when we end up finding out what's happened to Lara at school that things really start to go in another direction. And it's the outside world that Lara can't deal with. So when she's dealing with the world inside the apartment and then inside the apartment, the world of the glass menagerie, she's safe. I think that's why he gave the play that title. The original title of the play was The Gentleman Caller. He may have talked about this himself in one of his many books that have been written about him and with people who've had interviews with him and in the letters that have recently been published. But it would be interesting to see, did he change the title from The Gentleman Caller because he felt like that was the film version and The Glass Menagerie was the play version, because this work actually started life as a film. Tennessee was actually working in L.A. in a studio, and he was doing some writing, and he started writing the script, The Gentleman Caller, and it's really fascinating because there are a lot of scenes in the film script that aren't actually in the play. A lot of backstory events that you find out how Laura started buying the glass. The person who was selling her the glass was very important to her. So those are the two titles that the work has existed under, and he decided on The Glass Menagerie for the play.
A huge chunk of Act Two involves one scene between this gentleman caller who comes to the house ostensibly for dinner, but they want him to meet Laura. That could have been the focus. So the idea of calling it Glass Menagerie definitely does change it.
It does. It does. And, you know, it's interesting because when you're working on the play, there are seven scenes in the play, and six of them are relatively short, the first six scenes. And then the seventh scene is actually a 43-minute scene. The play is only 2 hours, so you've got a 43-minute seventh scene, and then, you know, the other six scenes take up, you know, a grand total of 77 minutes. And the actors talked about this a lot in rehearsal, where they felt like each scene was a piece that was setting up that one big scene between Lara and the gentleman caller. And of course, the whole family is involved intimately with that scene. You know, the first six scenes, you really get to understand who the family is, what their dynamics are, what the crisis that they're in is, what the boiling point is, what's about to break, what's really keeping them together. It's kind of fabulous construction. And then this gift of the seventh scene, one of the questions that keeps coming up in our talkbacks and the question-answer sessions that we have after each performance is people are saying, obviously, this is a memory play. We get that. We see how you've staged it to be that. You know, obviously, he tells us that's what it is. But how does Tom know what happens in that final scene between Laura and the gentleman caller, Jim? Because he's not there. And that's a very, very good point. He's not in that scene. There are a couple of scenes in the play that Tom's was not there. So how does he know if it's a memory play what happens in those scenes? And, you know, the actors, we were talking about it a lot, and the thing that they really felt was that Tom ultimately knew what happened, and then he used his imagination and his abilities as a storyteller, because, of course, he wants to be a poet in the play, to create the story of the scenes that he wasn't in. So we're not actually seeing what happened in the Wingfield house. We're seeing what Tom would like to have happened in those scenes.
There's one element that you added, which is ensuring that Tom is on stage at all time, and this is a very small space, so on some level he could have been overhearing.
True. Very, very true. Except for the where he would be at work in the earlier scenes, yeah. But yeah, it's, you know, that's an element that we decided to employ for our staging, which is that, you know, from the minute the play starts, there's nowhere for Tom to go. The small apartment that we've created is surrounded by a Escher-like maze of fire escapes that all link together and are hooked together and surround the apartment. So whenever Tom leaves stage and leaves the apartment, he goes up into these fire escapes, but he can't get out of them. So he eventually has to turn around and watch what's happening. So from the minute the play starts, he's stuck in the story until he finishes the story, which we really liked what that did. And it was interesting because, again, in the Q&As, we've had a lot of people ask, what's it like for Nick, who plays Tom, to sit there for that 40-minute scene and to watch it and to watch what happens to Laura over the course of that scene. And then, you know, he has to come back in for the very end of the play. You know, he said when he first heard that this is what we were going to do, he was just kind of scratching his head going, oh, my gosh, I got to sit on stage for 43 minutes watching this scene. And then when we actually started doing it, we'd only worked on the scene one or two times. He had the thought, I don't know how else I could do the last 5 minutes of the play if I wasn't sitting on stage watching that whole scene. He said, if I was allowed to go back to the green room and open a book and read and relax while the scene was going on, I don't know how I would come back out and be where I needed to be for those last 5 minutes. He said, it's priceless to be able to be there every night and watch that entire scene because it's got me exactly where I need to be for the end of the play.
This decision to focus on Tom, Amanda's a secondary character here, and yet in all of the other productions, that's the star. Part of it is, I think, that Nick Pelzer's so good in the role. To me, he's got the cadence and poetry, and as you said in a talk back the other day, when you brought him in, you didn't know he looked like Tennessee Williams, which was astonishing and changed the focus. Has Tom been the focus in other productions that you know?
I've seen a few productions where it was much more about Tom and, you know, his journey to have to tell this story. I've seen productions that have been very focused on Laura, as ours is, where Laura is so quiet that she becomes the center that Tom and Amanda are circling around, and then Jim comes into her orbit. You know, that was kind of what we were trying to do, because when I read the play, I see he starts the play talking to us and telling us that he has to tell this story, and he ends the play talking to Laura. He never talks to his mom. None of the monologues are addressed to his mother. The only character he addresses from the play is his sister, and he talks to her directly at the end of the piece and says goodbye to her. I really feel like the play is a journey about a man who has turned his back on his family, and the one that he feels he abandoned is his sister. He abandoned both his mother and his sister, but his mother is a survivor, much as he is. I have no doubt that his mother, and I don't think he has any doubt, that his mother made it through. Laura, on the other hand, she isn't one of the strong people. She's one of the people that needs other people to help her and to look after her and to take care of her. Although, you know, Anna Bullard, the actor who's playing Laura for us, would actually probably argue that point. She feels like Laura makes a massive change over the course of the play and is in a very different place at the end of the play than she is at the beginning of the play, which is interesting because I think you can kind of feel that a little bit too, the strength that she has as Laura at the end of the play. For me, the focus has always actually been Tom and Laura and not Amanda. That's why we do the plays, right?
This is the 100th anniversary of Tennessee Williams' birth. Aurora did Eccentricities of a Nightingale. SF Playhouse is currently doing Period of Adjustment, which is a later play and, oddly enough, a comedy. And now we've got his first play. So we've got an early play revised, the first success, and then a late play, but not late enough. I mean, it's still during his golden years. What drew you to Glass Menagerie, and were you drawn, let's say, to a lesser-known play like Period of Adjustment before choosing that?
I love Tennessee's body of work, the entire canon, and the first Tennessee Williams play that we did here when I became the artistic director was Streetcar Named Desire. Since that time, I have actually directed Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at Georgia Shakespeare in Atlanta. And so before Glass Menagerie, I had done two of the big three. I was really interested in revisiting Menagerie. Tennessee is someone that we want to produce on a regular basis here at Marin. I think people will be seeing us do more of his work over the coming years. And Menagerie was one that I felt like I had a very definite take on the play that I wanted to explore. I had a composer that I really wanted to work with on the play. And I had an idea of what I wanted to do with the play that just really made it feel like this was a great time to take a look at it. And, you know, so many people do have the opinion of Menagerie that it's a play about Amanda. You know, I felt like we had such a unique take on it in terms of, you know, taking it as a play about Laura and as a play that's really about Tom and Laura, that I felt like that was something that was worth revisiting in his centennial. So, oddly enough, we had been talking about Night of the Iguana as well, and that's a play that I think we're definitely going to try to get on our stage here very soon, although we're not the only company in the Bay Area that's talking right about doing that play, so, you know, we'll see who ends up doing it first. But he's got such an amazing body of work, and we felt like it was a good time to go back to Menagerie and take a look at it, because we haven't done it here at Marin Theater Company since the late 60s. So it's been quite a while since we've done the play here at the company. So we felt like it was a good chance to come back and take another look at it before we really branched off into some of the other plays.
Jason Menadakis, when you're creating the set, you said that you had some ideas about the music and the set. Did that come way before? Were those always in the back of your mind?
They were. When we did Streetcar Named Desire, the composer, Chris Houston, and I were talking about the next time we do one of these plays, it would be great to have a musician on stage, to actually have a live musician. Because when we did Streetcar, Chris wrote some amazing original jazz music, and we put together a five-piece in Berkeley jazz band, and we actually recorded all the music that we used for the show. And we said, you know, we'd love to actually use a live musician at some point down the road on one of these plays. So I had been thinking about that in terms of the different Tennessee Williams plays that we were looking at. And when I started reimagining Menagerie and thinking about the way I wanted to approach the play, a live musician on stage was just part of my thinking from the minute I started thinking about it. And originally I was thinking that perhaps it would be a saxophone that would be accompanying everything. And then when I was talking to our producing director here, Ryan Rillette, he said, you know, a saxophone is really warm, you know, in terms of the tonal quality of it. You might want to think about a brass instrument. And so that's where I started thinking about a trumpet. He was right. The trumpet has a much more lonely, melancholy, isolated sound than a reed instrument does. So the trumpet was just something that, you know, from the minute I started thinking about the play, in terms of seriously going about this version that I wanted to work on, I was thinking about what would it be like to have live underscoring the entire time. And the set really was part of my very initial thinking about the play. I knew that I wanted the space to be incredibly tiny. They're constantly talking in the play about how small the space is, and Tom has, there's a huge fight between Tom and Amanda that happens specifically because Tom is saying he's got no space. He's got nowhere to be himself. He can't get away from them ever. And I thought, okay, I've often seen Menagerie where they don't seem very poor because they seem to be living in a pretty nice place. And so we wanted to make sure that this was a tenement apartment, that it was incredibly tiny, that it was incredibly spare. We wanted to make sure that everybody was very aware that we were in the middle of the Great Depression. They make a big deal about money all throughout the play. And, you know, one of Amanda's big things at the end of the play and her disappointment in Tom is how much expense they've gone to for this evening that has now not ended terribly successfully. And every penny that this family has is incredibly important. And we wanted the audience to really feel that. So the set design was always incredibly important because I wanted it to be both open but confining. I wanted there to be a sense that there was no way to escape this place, that what you traditionally thought of as being up and down might get kind of confused. So, you know, in this play, they always talk about, you know, climbing the steps of the fire escape. And, of course, in our production, you both have to climb up and climb down the fire escape to actually get anywhere. You have to go up and down. It's not just up. You don't just go up to get to the front door. You have to go up and down to get to the front door. It's hard to explain if you're not actually looking at the set. But the set designer, Kat Connolly, who's actually from Atlanta, did an amazing job of really creating a very teeny tiny apartment that feels very cozy inside of it when the actors are in it, but then also feels very prison-like depending on how it's lit. And it's sort of, you know, what would happen if you removed all the bricks from the building and just left the skeleton of it, the fire escapes. It's a very haunting set. I love this set, and the actors adore playing the show on it. So it was always a very integral part of our thinking. When we started thinking that way, that's really where the prop design started to come in terms of, in Tennessee's original stage directions, he actually says, I don't want you to have any food, mime it, Tom can't remember any of this, so don't have, you know, don't have stuff that Tom can't remember. So we took that to an extreme and really stripped away anything that we didn't think Tom would specifically remember. So we have very few props in this show, very little furniture. They talk about things that aren't actually there. They use things that aren't actually there. You know, we've limited the menagerie to being the menagerie stand that's actually made out of glass, and then we only have one animal from the menagerie that's actually physicalized on stage. Laura certainly makes us all believe that there are many, many more pieces of glass there, but we only see one. And that was all incredibly intentional. The designers and I met a number of times before we actually started actually working on the design, where we went through, we all brought in lists of what we thought were the important props and furniture, and then we all argued about them. One of the things that had the biggest discussions about it was, were we going to have a front door to the apartment? We don't have any walls, but we do actually have the front door, and, you know, we had big arguments over whether it should be a screen door or whether it should be the wooden door. Should we have both of the doors or just one of the doors? And we ended up deciding that we needed one door and that it would actually be the screen door. So it's really interesting how the entire set design and prop design and the physical world of the play came into existence.
Is this kind of back and forth for the set pretty standard for every single thing you do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the great things about that working in this art form. It is such an incredibly collaborative form. Every designer that worked on this play had a lot to say about how we were going to actually physicalize the world, both in costumings and props and settings and sound and music. It was a really phenomenal experience with this design team.
In the press release, you made a comment that the soundscape and claustrophobic physical world, that you hope to find new reverberations in our own economically troubled times. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, you know, we're in what people are calling the greatest financial crisis for the, you know, American people since the Great Depression. And when Tom does that first monologue, it's funny every night how many titters we get of audience recognition of the fact that he's describing a time period that doesn't sound all that different from our own. He's talking about what's going on in Europe, that there are wars going on in Europe that we seem somehow separated from. There are these disturbances that are happening in the United States, some of them violent, some of them not so. And, you know, we opened this play right after Occupy Oakland went so badly. And it was just kind of strange that there were so many things that were happening in our own time period that felt so similar to what Tom was talking about. He was talking about, you know, the economic hardships that people were facing, the fact that, you know, the things that they were trying to do, the way they were trying to hold family together, that having a home was a very difficult thing. And it just has a lot of reverberations with our own time period. Adult children living at home with parents. I mean, you know, in this play, Tom is 22 and Laura is 24, and they're still living at home. They've, you know, they're post high school, after, you know, their college period, neither went, and they're back home and they're with their mother, and they're all working to make ends meet. So, you know, there are a lot of families around now that that's sort of the reality for them as well. We tend to think of ourselves as being in such a different time period, but it's not all that different.
At the talk back, you mentioned, Jason Minidakis, that there'd been a production where the audience was mostly, if not all, high school kids. How did they relate to it?
A lot of people have commented on how funny certain elements of this production are. The high school audiences have been right with Laura and Tom every step of the way. The things that they would laugh about, where the kids just could not understand when Amanda, why she was going in one direction or the other direction, how she was getting so upset. Anytime those two kids on stage were kind of like exasperated, those high school kids were laughing and relating to it. We've only done one. We've got two more coming up, one this week and one next week. But the actors have absolutely adored playing for these high school audiences, because the kids are so tapped into exactly where Tom is, you know, and understanding where Laura is as well. So, you know, it is a play about parents and children and about children trying to grow up and find out who they are. And I think high school age students are right at that point where, you know, that's what they're doing too. They're trying to understand that relationship between themselves and who they are as individuals, who they are as part of the family unit. So in a lot of ways, it's a great play to be seeing as a family right at this time of the year.
As I said before, Period of Adjustment by Tennessee Williams is playing at SF Playhouse, and it's playing through mid-January. If theatergoers go to see Menagerie and then Period of Adjustment, what in terms of Tennessee Williams will they be seeing that kind of compares with one another? What can they draw out from seeing both of them, do you think?
You know, the thing that's always remarkable about Tennessee's plays is he has an amazing ability to write the outsider and the people with incredibly sensitive ways of looking at the world, the person who could or would become the artist. I think it's always interesting to look at his plays and to find out who that person is and how they don't fit into a rougher world. Whether it's his comic plays or whether it's his tragic plays, he always has that character who's trying to figure out how to look at the world the way the rest of everyone else is looking at the world. You know, Jim in Menagerie actually has a monologue about the different people aren't like the other people. And that was kind of his first pass at figuring out who are the artists, who are the sensitive people, the way they look at the world. And, you know, he would go on to write Blanche and to write all these different people who looked at the world in such different ways. And I think that's something to look at his plays, to always see where is that point of view within the play and how does that fit into the greater world of the play, and, you know, what is he saying about art in our lives in each one of his plays. So that's something that I think is really interesting to take a look at when you're comparing two pieces of his work from different periods.